This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, The Business Station. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han here with me. Good morning, Han.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning to you listening right now.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that you're excited for the long weekend.
I am, always. You know, it takes me a long time to kind of ramp up, you know, and Friday I hit my peak, though, yep. Just in time for the weekend.
Just in time. That's when all the energy gets turned on, right? There you go. We're looking forward to the weekend, but stay with us today. This morning, we'll keep you up to date with all the news you need to know. We're going to keep you company all the way till 10 o'clock today, so stay with us, we're keeping a close eye on what's happening in the U.S. with Hurricane Florence, which is nearing the U.S. East Coast. Now, officials are warning that it could kill a lot of people. I'm using air quotes here on radio. This is according to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency in the U.S. They say that storm surges could bring catastrophic flooding to the inland areas.
Yeah, I guess those in the pathway of the storm can take some solace from the fact that it's now a Category 2. Previously, it was a Category 4. So in other words, that has weakened. And these stories just bring to mind my college days. I remember my freshman year in Florida, hurricanes coming, and we actually had to all gather in the hallway, take our mattresses.
To brace against the storm.
That's right.
Wow.
So we had the mattresses propped up against the windows and we were all huddled in the hallway and we had to just do sing-alongs for like a few hours. Yeah, it was...
Sing-alongs to take your mind off the
to pass
wind.
The time.
Oh, wow.
Because you couldn't watch your TV, and this was in 2001 where mobile phones were not as prevalent as
yeah.
it is now.
Well, you know, there's a lot of stories coming up from what's happening with Hurricane Florence. And one of the stories that caught my attention was a piece on the BBC that talked about why some people didn't want to leave their homes despite warnings from officials that, you know, the storm has been... could bring catastrophic effects.
Yeah, well, ultimately it comes down to a bet, right? Because the storm's path could change at any time, right? So, you know, do you want to go through all the hassle of moving everything you have, you know, and only to find out that nothing happened in your neighborhood? So it's a chance. There's also obviously the home bias, right? And what I mean by that is because you want to stay at home because that's where you're most comfortable. You recall Katrina and you saw all the images from the dome where they they put up all the victims, right? Mm. So it was just a mess, right? I mean, I guess to a much greater extent, say those who refuse to leave war-torn areas, same sentiment applies,
right,
in a way.
Like you want to defend the home front,
yeah.
right? You want to stay where you belong. Yeah, but, you know, weather worries are not just plaguing the U.S. It's also in the Philippines. Millions of those in the Philippines are now bracing for a storm, Typhoon Mangkhut. So thousands of people have begun evacuating from coastal areas in the Philippines as they're bracing for a super typhoon heading towards the country.
Yeah, so this one is currently a Category 4, and we'll see what happens when it hits one of the islands. So it's not just the Philippines, Hong Kong also taking precautions, as well as other parts in the coastal areas of southern China. Now, Philippines, though, you know, they've been hit about 20 typhoons and storms a year, but this one in particular, this is a massive one. I believe one of the strongest, if not the strongest, since records began.
Yeah, I think it was Haiyan. Remember Super Typhoon Haiyan? That was last year.
Mm.
And, you know, efforts to rebuild have only just kind of gotten some momentum. And now they're bracing for yet another major storm. All right, well, we'll keep a close eye on what's happening around the world. But after this, we're going to be discussing the pros and cons of collaboration. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 10 minutes past 6 o'clock. Wake up. That's not me. That's Arcade Fire. You just heard that on The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han this morning. And, you know, collaboration at work particularly is generally seen to be a good thing. But when is it not? So the latest survey by the Financial Times of what employers want from MBA graduates, it found that the ability to work in the team and to work with a wide variety of people were, I guess, among the top skills that employers wanted. So practical qualifications, things like accounting and programming and, you know, applied microeconomics, all those skills were among the least desired attributes. So in a nutshell, your ability to work in a team?
Yeah, so look, there are pros and cons, right? I guess the cons for working in a team is when it hits diseconomies of scale.
Well, meaning?
Well, Mel, you were an economics student. You should remember this.
Not applied macroeconomics.
All right, so diseconomies of scale is when, a company or a business, you know, grows so big that the cost of producing per unit of their good or service actually increases. So in textbook definitions, they always talk about, say, a kitchen, right? Mm-hmm. It's great if you've got three chefs who can work freely in the kitchen, but once you add more chefs, nobody can move and nobody can, you know, actually produce a good quality dish. So that's the idea, right? And, you know, it's great. I mean, democracy, you know, certainly has its merits. It's great to get as many stakeholders involved, but I think that ultimately there has to be a hierarchy of sorts. At the end of the day, get that feedback, get that input, but one individual, one party has to make that final decision.
Yeah, because I was thinking about when would be the times that collaboration is not a good thing, right? It would be few and far between. But I'm thinking there could be, the negative of it would be when you have, say, two brains are better than one, and you know the collective wisdom of crowds. What happens then when there's groupthink and herd mentality? So one person has, say, a more dominant personality and dominates, say, the others, then everyone thinks like that. And you won't get the depth of creativity as opposed to, say, smaller groups of people or, you know, individuals working separately, but in a small way, collaborative, but separately.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, the majority may not necessarily yield the best result. Yeah, sure, it may be the most democratic result, but not necessarily the best.
Have you ever tried getting a solution in a meeting? Oh
yeah,
my goodness.
Exactly.
Committees just don't work.
Exactly. You know, and so you get results like, you know, and this is a spectrum here. On one end of the spectrum, you got Boaty McBoatface to the other end. And on a more serious note, then you get Brexit and Donald Trump, right? So it may not be the best result per se, but it's the most democratic.
Yeah, and I agree with you in terms of, you know, there needs to be a hierarchy. So perhaps at a more ground level, working collaboratively, working in groups will be good, you know, so you want to have that kind of level of teamwork. But as you get higher, you need someone to make a decision, right? So the problem with meetings or committees sometimes, who makes that final call? Sometimes it's not always a democracy. It's not always the majority knows best.
And that's a very good point as well, because at the same time, while at risk of sounding perhaps more favorite towards authoritarianism, right? Because then that individual then comes into the question, the equation, right? Because that's assuming also you trust that individual, you know, to make a decision that's in the best interest of everyone. Because if you give that individual that authority, well, if that person makes the wrong choice, then you're screwed.
Yeah, so yeah, you're right. Definitely right. So you have to be able to, I guess, trust in the skills and the leadership of the person that is going to make that decision. But I'm wondering with this Financial Times survey, why do you think that employers treasure or really, I guess, you know, put high value on teamwork or working collaborative or the ability to work with different types of people?
Well, I mean, because, you know, ultimately you would like to think that the sum is greater than the parts, right? So that's the idea here. But then, you know, when you look at, say, some very successful entrepreneurs, Steve Jobs comes to mind.
Notoriously tough to work
with. Yeah, Steve Jobs comes to mind, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, they are the ones up there barking their orders. You know, I was reading this story about Elon Musk, you know, how sometimes he would just send emails with just the three letters WTF and expects a response immediately.
Wow.
You know, so it's those kind of attitudes that really kind of shake up the industry.
But, you know, there are some jobs that are naturally, for the solo worker, right? And I've noticed that too. Now, I've been in print media when I found myself working alone and, you know, you're going out by yourself, doing your assignments, and then you're working by yourself, essentially, as opposed to in broadcast where you really are part of a team and, you know, your team is only as strong as your weakest.
All this cliche is just coming out, right?
I'm just throwing it out there.
How many can we fit in, you know, before 6:30 here?
No, I can go on for sure. Well, tell us what you think. Again, our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. It's coming up to 6:15 now. We'll be back with a look at how sometimes grades aren't everything on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Okay, go there with This Too Shall Pass. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Cheng Han here with me. It's coming up to 22 minutes past 6 o'clock this morning, the Friday Friday the 14th of September. The Friday?
It is the Friday of the Friday. September. Yes.
Right. We're going to turn our attention now to Singapore, where a few parents there have banded together and started this new initiative called, I believe it's called Life After Grades. So this initiative is aimed at changing parental expectations with regards to grades, simply to, I guess, broaden society's definition of success beyond academic success. Mm.
All right, now, just to be clear here, okay, the Life Beyond Grades movement does not claim that, quote, studying is unnecessary or that any kind of enrichment is wrong. So rather, the goal is to broaden the definition of success beyond just the academic pursuits, right? So look, I get it because this is an expected evolution post Singapore topping the latest PISA scores, because before there was Finland, and even now they're saying, look, we're going to move up past the A's. I interviewed the equivalent of the education minister for Finland right here on the Breakfast Grill. You can check out that podcast. And they're also saying, look, we're not so worried about the A's or the topping of the PISA scores anymore. We're looking beyond that. And so you got Singapore now perhaps jumping on that bandwagon as well.
Yeah, but also I think it's not just beyond academic success, but also, you know, to say, I think part of what they are trying to do is to give children more time to play. So cut down on going to tuition classes, show them that grades don't define who they are. And more often than not, the pressure comes from the parents, right? How many A's your kids get? And that's, you know, a conversation that you'll have at family reunions. It becomes, I guess, some bragging rights, right, for some parents. And these group of parents for Life Beyond Grades, Life After Grades, excuse me, or Beyond Grades, they want to move the conversation beyond just that, you know, so you can be proud that your child is in theatre or, you know, is successful in sports or has won a game or a match or can sing, you know, other things. E-gaming, isn't it? Yeah.
That's right, you know, for those kids who might still be in their 20s, 30s and living out of your parents' basement and playing your video games, there's still hope for you, perhaps. Look, but I think I want to challenge this notion, or not challenge, but just kind of quantify it a little bit more, because I would say that education or academic success is disproportionately more important for those perhaps in the less well-off segments of society than those in the upper echelons of society.
Sure.
I mean, because for the richer folk, to put it bluntly, they've got not just a network of capital, so you can get money from your parents, relatives, etc., or you can also rely on a cultural capital status that comes to the family as well. So I'll give you a personal example, right? So after the 98 financial crisis, I actually became a Pasar Malam boy, right? So my family and I, we worked in a Pasar Malam for a few years after 1998. Then subsequently, I then went to the States. Now, it's easy for me to just say, yeah, you know, I was able to bootstrap my way and go to the States and get a scholarship and, you know, do it all on my own. But you know, that would I would be remiss if I didn't recognize, say, the help, the financial aid that I got from my grandma, right? You know, for example, or the fact that I was born and raised in an English-speaking home that helped me assimilate well into the American culture, right? So it's these kind of other sociological factors that can lend itself to one's success more so than grades.
So are you saying that this is perhaps, you know, something that the lower income, lower social classes may not be able to, I guess, benefit from, right? So you can't actually say there's life beyond grades, you know, if grades is what's going to get you out of a certain socioeconomic class.
Yeah, no, because look, when it comes to academic success, it is a great leveler in terms of you know, trying to reduce that divide between the haves and have-nots, right?
But what about meritocracy? So in a society that I guess espouses a meritocracy, wouldn't that be, you know, wouldn't that level the playing field?
Yeah, well, that is an ideal, though. That is an ideal, but ultimately, I mean, you look at the growing disparity, the growing inequality in the global wealth now, right? Now, the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, right? So that ideal is, I think, far from reality still. It's something we can strive towards, but we got a long ways to go. Until then, kids, make sure you strive for those A's.
Well, tell us what you think. Do you think not focusing on grades is an impossible dream? We want to hear from you. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We've got the 6:30 News Bulletin coming up next on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Hang Down Your Head by Tom Waits. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han this morning, 6:42 right now. You're listening to The Morning Run. And as we were talking a little bit about how we can try to not focus on grades, or perhaps that's an impossible dream, we put that question out there. And Roland Tan has come back with his feedback. He says that academic success gives one a good head start, without which career success is still possible, just much tougher, I guess.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree, because, you know, the global system when it comes to assessing merits, you know, the education system is very much ingrained into that grading system, so to speak, right? How do you assess someone's skills and abilities you know, easier than just looking at whether it's A, B, or C, or whether you graduated in the top 10%? I mean, I'm not saying that defines the person. The A doesn't just define the person, but it's going to take a lot more resource, a lot more time to ascertain the person's ability.
But you're a teacher too, right?
That's right.
So does that kind of, do you feel weird making that argument? That grades are not everything?
Actually,
would you tell your kids that?
I tell my kids exactly that, because ultimately when it comes, okay, so we've got the IGCSE, the Cambridge IGCSE is coming up literally in 2 weeks from now, okay? So what I tell these kids is that, look, this is basically the key to the next door in the next phase of life.
Sure.
That's it.
It's just one step up. Yeah.
Once you go through that door, you know, there are other things there, you know, connections, your network, your cultural capital, etc.
Your soft skills. Yeah.
But this key is important and that door is there. So walk through it.
Well said. All right. Well, another story we're keeping an eye on today, this past few days, has been what's happening in Kelantan, because Pakatan Harapan chairman Hussam Musa, he's alleging that the past led government in Kelantan had acquired a Mercedes-Benz for one of its high-ranking officials. So in response to that, the Kelantan Deputy Menteri Besar had come out to say, well, the rationale for buying the car was because the maintenance cost for that vehicle specifically was actually lower than other marquees.
Okay, so that's what he says.
Spend money to save money.
Yeah, well, I've never owned a Mercedes, so I don't know what the maintenance costs. But what he's claiming is that, oh, it's apparently cheaper than Toyota and you know, other brands, right? But then, you know, this reminds me of an instance with Lim Kuan Eng, our now Minister of Finance. You know, back in at the end of 2013, I believe, yeah, December 2013, he had to fend off those same criticisms. The Penang State government got a whole bunch of Toyota Camrys in October of that year. Then, a couple of months later, hey, he got himself a Mercedes, specifically a Mercedes-Benz S300L. So the justification back then was that not just maintenance, but also they got a huge discount, about half the price from Mercedes in order to get that car. But then, you know, does that message actually fit well with the masses? I mean, apparently in this case, with the Kelantan state government, not quite.
Well,
right?
This was specifically, I think, because Hussam Musa was making making comments that, or was saying that this, the optics don't look good, right? Especially, you know, the acquisition could raise concerns that perhaps Kelantan's coffers were not as healthy, or, you know, so the I guess there was a whole connotation about where the money came from, mm-hmm. and why they needed the car. Was it to run official duties, and how does it save money in the long run? So those were, I guess, some of the questions that Hussam Musa had put out there, and it made me think a little bit about whether we generally don't like our politicians to be flaunting wealth, you know. It's there's something about that rubs us the wrong way, or that makes us suspicious. And I recall a similar case in Singapore as well. I think one of the politicians there, having come from, I think, old money or a wealthy family, was seen parking a Rolls Royce, and that had triggered some reaction in Singapore.
Yeah, like with Kelantan's case, it's highly suspect, because, you know, this state continues to get funds from the federal government, even to pay salaries for Kelantan's civil servants. You know, Lim Guan Eng announced that actually Kelantan has been receiving the highest monetary aid from the federal government, close to $1 billion, just to deal with their cash deficit and expenditure, yet they are spending on the Mercedes-Benz. Now, I get that. I guess ultimately it boils down to whether you view these leaders, these politicians as leaders, and by extension, they should be accorded some level of status and stature, Or should they be seen as public servants? Where is the emphasis? Because if they're public servants, then you gotta, you know, be more in line with the common folk here in Malaysia, lah.
Well, tell us what you think. Our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we're going to come back and take a look at comments made by Dato' Sri Nazri Aziz saying that he will campaign for Anwar Ibrahim. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:51 right now. That was Cream with Outside Woman. The inside woman here today is Melissa Idris of The Morning Run with Tan Chung Han.
Hey, look, you are really giving me a run for my money in terms of the cheesiest. Yeah,
today.
Oh my gosh. You're really trying there, but I give you credit because I see
I want that crown, the bad pun crown. Coming back to our conversation a little bit earlier about whether politicians should be seen to have wealth, Ro, our favorite Ro, has weighed in this morning. He's almost guest hosting with us this morning. He has said that, if I'm not mistaken, he witnessed MP Fahmi stepping out of a chauffeur-driven Alphard. Firstly, he doesn't know whether it is the MP's, but Ro thinks it's irrelevant. As long as the MP serves his constituents well and it's his private and not state-related income, so be it. However, Ro does feel that Bata-style austerity is incredibly endearing to the rakyat.
That's a valid point, I think. Well, then you got KY Ho, who's taking a more pragmatic approach in terms of the topic that we discussed earlier. He or she says, KY Ho says that cars should look at life cycle costs, not just purchase or maintenance costs. Public cars should be fit for purpose. So the question is a Mercedes-Benz fit for a civil servant or a state leader? You know, depends on how you want to define that individual.
Well, join our conversation this morning. Our Twitter handle is at BFM Radio, or you can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Now, let's take a look at whether you can work with someone you don't like or trust. And I'm referring to news that UMNO's Padang Rengas MP, Dato' Sri Nazri Aziz, former tourism minister, he says that he's going to be campaigning for PKR president-elect, Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim, in the coming Port Dickson by-election. And this was reported by Malaysia Kini, and I love that the next line says, he was quoted by Malaysia Kini as saying, "I'm serious." So I think he was responding to the look on the journalist's face. So he had to say, "Yes, I'm serious." So Dato' Sri Nazri Aziz is saying he wanted to campaign for UMNO because he believes that that is what is best for UMNO to pave its return into government. I'm just wondering whether, you know, there's no permanent friends or enemies in politics, but how many times can you go on that merry-go-round, right?
Yeah, you know, and I guess whether or not we can draw lessons from the Malaysian political landscape and apply it to our work lives. So, for example, I actually, my current career path actually started off on some pretty unsavory terms.
I didn't know this before we hired you.
Yeah, no, so don't go digging up too far back, okay? No, it wasn't me per se, but we had actually some clashing individuals who actually set me on this current path, career path, mm-hmm. without getting into too much details, right? And so that really struck me because, you know, it was so important in bringing me to where I am today. I just hoped that or wish it could have been under more pleasant circumstances, right? So I guess ultimately the point I'm trying to make here is don't burn your bridges, right, whenever possible, because you just never know when you might have to work with your enemies again. We are seeing that here in this Malaysia Baru with the Pakatan government, Tun Dr. Mahathir and Dr. Sri Anwar working side by side. And looks like now Nazri is joining that bandwagon as well.
Well, okay, so it's really about a common goal, isn't it? So
yeah.
If you have something you want to achieve together, then, you know, your enemy's enemy is your best friend, right? So you want... I'm so full of cliches this morning. I'm just going to stop right now. But it really is that. It's about, you know, if you have a common goal, then you're able to work no matter with whomever, whatever bad blood in the past. I'm just wondering whether there's a line to be drawn,
yeah.
whether there's a certain level of distrust. You know, it just feels like at some point, you just have to, you know, draw the battle lines. You have to know which side you're on.
Yeah, you know, and then what happens to your principles then, right? Because if, let's say, this person has wronged you and gone against what you stand for, then really, it to protect the integrity of your principles, there really should be no coming back from that, I think.
But Han, to completely negate my own point, what yeah. about, you know, just having that professionalism, right? So let's take the work setting. So say we're in the office and there are people, you know, you're not going to get along with everyone. There are people that you may not like, may not get along with, may not even trust, but you have to work together, right? So there's something about being a professional and just turning up for the job. So perhaps this is, you know, beyond just a common goal, being professional. Let's work together so we can achieve this.
Yeah, you know, well, that sounds great and ideal, but then at the same time, if let's say this person again has gone against professional values or done something wrong, you know, using that argument, you could almost use it as a slippery slope to then cover for the individual. Like, in other words, let's not out this person because of what he or she did or said just to keep the organization going. Then you might be complicit in a cover-up, right? So yeah, it's a very, very tough balance to strike here, though.
Okay, there you go. Let's find out more from the news headlines this morning. We've got the 7 o'clock news bulletin up next with Sabrina Magdalene on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.